one man's exploration.
Metal and us metalheads are part of a much bigger story than I ever could have imagined.
Yeah!
It was stupefying.
It just feels awesome. That's what metal is about.
Through the history of metal.
That was sort of how Metallica got its start.
We could go as far as we wanted to go on stage.
What were the main inspirations for that opening riff?
That's what we are. Or war.
People either want to f*** us or fight us.
We viewed, like, the hair bands as our nemesis.
We were trying new things that nobody else has done.
The groundbreaking 11-part series from Banger Films.
This is my journey into the evolution of heavy metal.
Metal Evolution. Premieres November 11th at 10. Only on VH1 Classic.
Hi everybody, welcome to Midnight Movie Cowboys. This is a new four-part series that we are doing, and no, it's not another B-Team one, because there's only Hunter and myself this time, no Andrew. We managed to scuttle him out the door, so he come back.
It was hard, man. He just doesn't know when to get out, you know?
He's like that guest. He's that guest that just won't leave. It's like
he's the guest. He's the guy at the party who's first to arrive, last to leave.
Last to leave. And, you know, he doesn't get the hint when you're looking at your watch thinking, well, you know, hey, we're getting really tired. But no, yeah. we're just kidding, Andrew. Andrew's always
He just wants to keep talking about Asylum movies and Frankenfish and stuff.
Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
We're just kidding. We love you, Andrew.
Of course we do. Kisses, Andrew. Kisses on the bottom. Isn't what Paul McCartney said? Oh, not Paul McCartney. We've spoken about before. Okay, but we are going to talk about music this time around. What we are going to be talking about is the series Metal Evolution by Sam Dunn and Scott McFadden, the guys over at Banger Films.
Yeah, we've been wanting to talk about these dudes for a while. I mean, we talked about them a little bit on our 2010 show with their excellent Rush documentary.
Yes.
But we've been wanting to talk about them for a while. They're kind of the chroniclers of metal on film. They did Metal A Headbanger's Journey, which created a lot of waves in the metal community. I mean, I just saw it at the store one time and just went, oh, this looks like it's up my alley, and I just bought it.
Mm-hmm.
And they followed it up with a movie called Global Metal, which looked at the metal scenes in various parts of the world that are like lesser developed or kind of niche.
Now, that's one that you and I watched when I was at your place in Memphis, because I'd never heard of it. You said, oh,
yeah,
you
I mean,
Global Metal. Like, okay, I've never heard of it.
It was weird. Like, I had no idea it existed, but I loved Metal A Headbanger's Journey so much. I mean, I raced out to get it when I heard about it.
Yeah.
They also did a great concert film with Iron Maiden jet setting around the world in their jet with Bruce Dickinson flying it, called Iron Maiden Flight 666.
That was very good.
Concert films are kind of a dime a dozen. A lot of them are just a concert being shot. This one takes you all over the world. You see just these massive crowds they play to in, like, you know, Chile and Australia and Mexico. It's fucking amazing. And then they did Rush Beyond the Lighted Stage, which chronicled Rush, which Rush has not had a proper documentary done about them. So
no, they haven't.
It was cool because, like, you know, they're not a band that's, like, known for doing a lot of drugs or, you know, screwing lots of women.
No real scandal attached to Rush that would warrant a documentary on the band. They're just clean living sort of guys. And what are they, the third highest selling artist of all time?
They have the third most consecutive gold and platinum records after the Beatles and Stones.
I mean, that's a hell of an accolade. I mean,
the music press ignores them.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, but they're finally getting into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Well, the music press ignores them, but the audience doesn't.
Well, it's the same thing with Maiden. Like, Maiden never had any real radio play. I mean, Rush did during moving pictures and stuff. But, you know, Maiden was kind of a, you know, word of mouth phenomenon, and now they're like, you know, one of the biggest bands out there.
Isn't it amazing that Maiden's still one of the biggest metal bands after all these decades, really?
And I saw them live a couple years ago, and they're so good live.
I haven't seen Maiden since 85 on the World Slavery Tour. It's the last time I caught them. I know my brother caught
them. That guy just leaps around on stage. I mean, he's just such a presence, you know?
He really is.
He's one of the great frontmen that, you know, you don't read about a lot.
Have you ever seen Blaze Bailey on stage?
Yes.
He's like an animatronic.
He's really boring. There's a great video of him doing the Trooper, which, you know, Blaze was the guy who replaced Bruce Dickinson when he left to pursue a solo career, and they did two albums with him.
Yeah, two horrible albums.
And, you know, Bruce is a very high register vocalist, like soaring vocalist. Blaze is very low register. Like he's kind of like a British sounding, less interesting version of Glenn Danzig, I guess. You know,
he's more like Leonard Cohen, I think.
Yeah, but so like, you know, the songs they did with him, you know, they were kind of flat, not that great. And it's funny, like, because when Bruce came back, he did a few Blaze era songs live, and he just demolishes them.
Didn't he? Yeah, it was just like a complete re-scrap of them and just.
They sounded like Maiden songs.
They did again.
But like, when Blaze did Bruce material live, it was atrocious.
It was bad.
But there's a video online of him doing the Trooper, which, you know, is if you know Blaze's voice, him doing the Trooper is atrocious. and just the thought of it, you're like, and it's as bad as you think it is. But there was some dude spitting on him on stage, and he loses his shit in the middle of the song and calls upon the audience to kill the person who's doing it. I thought that was a little extreme.
That's a bit much.
Yeah.
Okay.
But
Metal Evolution is the one that we're talking about. Now, we're going to give you the breakdown of how we're doing this. This is an 11-part series, Metal Evolution, 11 episodes based on different genres of metal. We're going to be doing this in four parts. So part one of our show will be episodes 1 to 2, Part 2 will be episodes 3 to 5. Part 3 will be episodes 6 to 8. And part 4 will be episodes 9 to 11. So that's the breakdown of that. So there'll be a few episodes in each part of our series. We didn't want to do 11 episodes on 11 episodes. Just a bit of overkill.
And if you want to watch this, you can see it at VH1.com.
For those of you in North America, anyway.
Yeah. If you're in the States, like me... Yeah, you can see it on VH1.com. The only thing is the episode on New Wave of British Heavy Metal is not on there for whatever reason, but you can see it on Amazon.
But for those of you outside of North America, I know in Australia here it's been released on DVD and Blu-ray. And Britain, the UK, is getting a DVD release and Blu-ray release mid-November, I believe.
Mm-hmm. And those releases are much better than the one we got in Region 1.
Which is a DVD-R.
It's a DVD-R, yeah. It's just a burned thing, and because I was going to buy it and add it to my Sam Dunn shelf, and I went on Amazon when it became available, so I was just going to buy it, and then I saw the star rating was very low.
Yeah.
And I was like, uh-oh. Something's and it wrong. Turned out it was a DVD-R, and the video was awful, and apparently it would often fail or skip, or, you know, it just was it's a non-release. So avoid the Region 1 copy. I mean, I think the Australian one is region free. So
yes, sources tell me that the Blu-ray is region free, and so is the DVD, I believe. Also, speaking of that, we need to thank over here in Australia, Beyond Home Entertainment and Leanne in marketing for getting out a copy of this to us to review.
So, yeah, thank you,
Leanne. Thanks, Beyond, our new friends over there. Okay, so Metal Evolution.
Let's do it. Episode 1.
Okay, episode 1. Let's do this. The Prehistory of Metal is the first one. Now, these are a VH1 production. They run about 42 minutes per episode. So they're kind of condensed. I mean, because I get the feeling when you watch some of Sam and Scott's work, they're very elaborate. They elaborate a lot on things. These feel a bit trimmed. A little bit. So there are some omissions and stuff that we're going to be bringing up. And there was also a lot of goodness in here. We're not just going to completely say, well, they didn't do this right. They missed this. There is a lot of goodness in this series as well. We're just going to critique
this. Also, like, this, I think, is a more thorough examination of metal than Metal: A Headbanger's Journey.
Oh, absolutely.
Because, like, you know, in a feature film, you have to you can only pack so much into an hour and a half or whatever.
Yeah.
This is a little more. I mean, I think with TV, yeah, you know, some of the subjects, you know, it's a lot to cover in 45 minutes, but. You know, when you look at the series as a whole, it's a very comprehensive...
Oh, it's very extensive.
Yes.
But do you get the feeling after you watch the whole series that there's got to be a Metal Evolution Part 2, surely?
Well, they are working on another episode, but we'll get to that at
later.
The end.
All right. All right, well, let's tear into Episode 1, Prehistory of Metal.
Yes.
And what we get to see... Now, did you notice one thing? And I'm sure you would have noticed it. And for those of you who do see this series and when you do watch it, if you didn't know the Iron Maiden song, The Trooper, before this series, you're going to know it after the series. Because
yeah.
You hear
may,
it at
you
the
may
start.
Be sick of it after the series.
You will be, yeah. You get a bit tired of it at the while because you hear the opening riff of The Trooper at the start of the show. You hear the... opening riff of The Trooper at the closing credits. So you times it by 11 episodes, you got that 22 times. And for someone like myself, and I dare say Hunter's heard it many, many, many times over the years,
Yes.
It gets a bit trying on the ears. But, you know, that's whatever. That's cool. I personally, what I would have done myself is I would have picked a track relevant to the episode that you're doing.
Sure.
Maybe keep The Trooper as your opening theme just to keep it uniformed for each side of it. But each episode at the end, pick a track that's relevant, say, to the Prehistory Metal. You know, what's
indeed.
Wrong with putting a Jerry Lee Lewis track in there or
a Howlin' Wolf.
Oh, man. Yeah. All right. So
Howlin'
what we get
Wolf's
off, we
man.
Get the opening credits. We get an extensive family tree. Let me ask you something. I want to ask you a question personally. This is not related to the show. But this is just me personally asking you. What drew you to metal? What was the thing that drew you to heavy metal besides rap? Because you would have been at the age right then when rap was really coming in with the Two Live Crew. And
well, you know, when I was growing up in Texas, I really... did not have an appreciation for music until I got into high school. I mean, I like little things here and there.
Yeah.
Like, I kind of liked Weird Al because here's the thing is I hated most music I heard.
Right.
I thought it was all shit. Like, because everybody I went to school with was listening to Nirvana. And, you know, I mean, I kind of appreciate Nirvana now.
Yep.
But when I was a kid, I couldn't stand them. And people were listening to... Dave Matthews Band, and to me Dave Matthews Band represents everything that blows ass about music.
Yeah.
Just condensed into just a big shitty pile of shit. So that's what everybody was listening to, and I had no interest in it. I liked some musicals and some little things here and there, and I liked Weird Al because he made fun of music I didn't like. And I thought it was funny and it made me laugh. So when I was in 8th grade, I kind of started warming up to Green Day.
Do you have the time to listen to me whine about nothing and everything all at once? I am one of those melodramatic fools, neurotic to the bone, no doubt about it. Sometimes I give myself the creeps. Sometimes my mind plays tricks on me. It all keeps adding up. I think I'm cracking up. Am I just paranoid? Am I just up?
Like,
oh, okay.
For a while, they were one of those... I mean, they're one of the few bands I started off on that I have since moved away from. I don't like them anymore. Occasionally, if I hear one of their older songs, I'll enjoy it, but... You know, they're just something totally different now.
But see, Green Day really don't have any metal elements to them apart from the guitar.
No.
Which is...
Well, it's fast and it's kind of hard like the Ramones, but it's not metal.
No.
But so what happened was is I had a friend who was into Metallica, and we were on a vacation together, and we went to this record store in Maine, and he said, you got to get a Metallica record. Like, I was like, I'm going to buy a CD while I'm here. I'm going to find a CD and enjoy it. And he goes, you got to get a Metallica CD.
Yep.
And I was looking through him, and he pulled out Master of Puppets, and he said, start with this one.
Yeah. Good choice.
And at first I really kind of, I was blown away by Battery and stuff. And at first I kind of didn't know what to make of it. And then I really warmed up to it and I really liked it.
Yeah.
And what made it more appealing was everyone I went to school with by the time I got into high school hated the music I was listening to. They didn't like Metallica. I had a couple of friends who were really into them.
Yep.
But the people everybody at school hated Metallica. They were like, that's old. Green Day, that's old, you know?
Jesus.
But so there was a guy on the bus who was kind of a stoner burnout guy, and he was always listening to a Walkman. Mm. And he was like, what kind of music do you like, man? Like, you know?
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, I like Metallica and Green Day. And he was like, oh, Metallica, they're no good, but you need to listen to The Damned, you know?
Oh, The Damned.
And The Damned. And so he said, you're going to love The Damned. And I was like, oh, they sound kind of evil. And I listened to him, and I was like, this is a great fucking band. But so I kind of got started on punk and metal and with Metallica, but Metallica led to Megadeth, led to...
Your favorites?
Oh, of course. Like, it was funny because I knew Anthrax because of Bring the Noise by Public Enemy.
Yeah.
And then I discovered Anthrax, and they became one of my all-time favorites just because they had a fun sense of humor. Music was just a lot of fun to listen to.
Yeah.
Like, you know, Slayer is cool and all, but it can get pretty oppressive pretty quick, you know?
Very much.
But, you know, and it just, I started exploring all kinds of metal, you know, started going into, Swedish death metal, like In Flames kind of took me down a harder path.
Yeah.
Started listening just to everything I could get my hands on. So.
Oh, okay.
What about you?
Me being a bit older than you, for those of you out there who don't know, who've just latched onto the show, I'm actually about a dozen years older than Hunter, 12, 13 years older. So my first song that really turned me on to hard rock was The Stroke by Billy Squire.
Nice.
When I heard that, my mind just fucking blew. It was like, this is awesome. This guy rules, and this song rules. And then after that, my dad went out with my brother and myself one day, and he picked up on cassette Deep Purple in Rock.
He got home,
and we played it, and that was it. World changed. I heard Deep Purple in Rock was all over, and that was it. I became a convert to metal. And luckily after that, that was about 82, my dad bought that tape. I think
so. Metal was really taking hold in the mainstream.
It was because Number of the Beast had just come out.
Yeah,
and it was just. I mean, people now can't fathom just how massive Number of the Beast was when it came out.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I missed it when it first hit. I got into it for a friend of our family. One of their kids was a couple of years older than me, and he just had like a Number of the Beast Peace of Mind, and it's like all this cool Maiden shit he had. But I liked Maiden, but I was really leaning towards Deep Purple. So I found Machine Head, I found Fireball, Made in Japan, Burn, all
Made in Japan's pretty great.
It's one of the eponymous live albums of all time, I dare say. And
what do you think of the Coverdale years there?
The Coverdale ones were good. Let me rephrase it. I liked Burn a lot. I think Burn's a good album. I think Stormbringer, apart from the actual title track Stormbringer, is absolutely terrible.
I really can't
stand it. It's just, it's so blues country based.
Well, that's Coverdale coming in there, you know, because he's such an R&B kind of inflected guy.
Same with Glenn Hughes, though, as well, because he had a lot of the hand in the writing and the singing on those two Deep Purple albums. And then by the time Coverdale and Glenn Hughes are gone, you know, like, I knew about Mark III with, what was it, the guitarist's name? Tommy Bolin.
Oh.
Yeah. And he was, I just like, what was that album I did with Tommy Bolin? Who Do We Think We Are? I was like, I just don't want to even know. Because I was just a huge convert of Richie, like a huge disciple of Richie Blackmore. I was like,
yeah.
I don't want to know about this guy.
Did you like Rainbow?
I did like Rainbow, actually. I didn't latch on the Rainbow till a lot later because I was like,
I discovered Rainbow when I was on a Dio kick. And
yeah.
You
do that.
You know, I heard their first Richie Blackmore's Rainbow self-titled album.
Mm.
And apart from like a couple of tracks like Man on the Silver Mountain, I thought it was pretty just, you know. But Rainbow Rising.
That's a good one.
Is off the chain. That's a great... You got Jimmy Bain on the bass. It was funny. He said he had a Stormbringer t-shirt on in one of the episodes of this show. And Blackmore told him to take it off.
Like, yeah.
He said he had no sense of humor about Stormbringer. He hated it.
It's not very good.
Yeah. And you know, the third record they did... what's it called? Long Live Rock and Roll.
Yeah,
that's a good one, too.
Very, very good.
And then Blackmore kicked everyone out, and who gives a shit, you know?
Yeah, after that, it was just like... You got, who did he get on vocals? Was it Graham Bonnet?
Yeah, I think so.
It was like, no thanks. But yeah, Deep Purple was the one that just got me into it, because I got to actually see Deep Purple on their Reformation tour, the Perfect Strangers one in 84.
Yeah, that's a Perfect Strangers is a good song.
It's a good album, actually. It's a fantastic. First concert I ever went to, and I will go on the record saying still loudest concert I ever went to.
Wow.
Unbelievably loud, ridiculously loud. And I loved every second of it. And that was December 84. I remember there was a day we broke up for school in December, because we break up for school in December here. And I knew that night I'm going to go see Deep Purple with Dad and a couple of friends. So that was that. That was the one that got me into metal. I will always hold the candle for Deep Purple. These days, the wick is sort of burnt out a bit, but I will always play these Deep Purple albums regularly.
Yeah, I mean, I've got Made in Japan, and that's a killer record.
You know, Ian Gillan said he can't listen to it.
Really? Why?
Because he hates these vocals on it. I thought, what is wrong with you, man? They are perfect. He goes, I can't stand them.
I can kind of get that. Some people just really get uncomfortable listening or watching themselves, you know?
No, I think Ian Gillan's one was just like, my vocals weren't quite right on that album. So, no, not listening to it. But, yeah, that was it for me. But, okay, let's get in the meat potatoes of the show.
Yeah, sure.
We get some interviews at the start. We get, what do we get? We get Sebastian Bach / Odorous Urungus from Gore. Did you like that?
Yep.
It's like, what are you doing on this show, Gore, of all people?
And of course he's in costume.
Of course he's in. I mean, I wish Dave Brocky had actually just come out as Dave Brocky and they just had Odorous down there, because he's done it plenty of times. But obviously for the episode, they wanted to just have Odorous on there. Then we get that scene. Remember that scene where they go to... Sam goes to the Neuro Center and gets those things put on his head?
Yes, they do. How does metal affect your brain waves? Like, what? How do you scientifically explain the effect metal has on people? And then he goes and has these things attached to his head, and they play, like, some nice, mellow classical music.
Yeah.
And then they play Slayer's Raining Blood, and it's just, like, going nuts. And this is absolutely true what they say, because when I listen to metal, I think everything's a good idea. It's like cocaine.
Yeah.
You know? They said it demolishes your inhibition.
Yeah, that's true.
Or it doesn't demolish it, but it severely hampers it, and because of the effect it has on your brain waves. And that's why, you know, you go to a metal show and just people are going nuts and in the mosh pit and stuff.
Unless you're in Japan. If you're in Japan, they just stand there and clap after every song.
Oh, yeah. They're wired differently or something.
I've seen Judas Priest concerts when they're over in Japan. It's like they just stand there and then they applaud. I even saw them do it with Public Image Limited concert.
Oh man,
yeah, I mean, yeah, of all bands. Okay,
they were so polite, such a polite people,
very polite. But then we get into a section of the actual episode I really like, which is the early roots where they dug into the very early roots of metal. I'm not talking about Black Sabbath. If we're going further back than that, we're going to
We're going back to the days of
Paganini.
Niccolò Paganini. Thank you.
Yep.
And you're going back to those early classical roots. And, you know, they talk to Yngwie Malmsteen, who shows up in like a sports car with a red hat turned backwards on it.
Did you like his collection of red Porsches that he had?
Oh, my God.
He drove in through the gates in a red Porsche with Sam in the car with him. And then there's just like three other red Porsches that look exactly the same in the yard.
Backups, just in case, you know.
Yeah, just in case.
Oh my gosh, Yngwie Malmsteen is one of the most ridiculous people in metal.
I mean, gifted, but
absolutely
ridiculous. Yeah,
he's also kind of not fun to listen to. I mean, his music is really it's neoclassical. I mean, it's really technical, really just kind of music school type stuff.
Well,
like,
you get a perfect example. You get a perfect example of that when you see him playing the guitar with that orchestra. It's like,
yeah,
nobody else would ever think of that. Okay, yeah, it's original. Well, kind of, because John Lord did it back in 69 with an orchestra of some sort. He wrote some piece that got performed. Yeah, Yngwie is just, I mean, he's really weird. Did you ever hear that piece that that outburst he did on the airplane years ago?
Yeah. What is it? You've Unleashed the Fury?
It's like, what are you talking about, you idiot?
He was wasted on an airplane and flipped out on a woman.
Yeah, one of the stewardesses on a plane. He's like,
and so he named his new album Unleashed the Fury.
Did he really?
Yes.
What a dick. Yngwie, listening, you're a dick. You and your
he's a talented porch. Dick, though.
Talented dick, but you're a fucking dick still.
Yeah, he's a interesting guy, and they talked to the dude whose name eludes me, who was in The Scorpions.
Oh, Uli John Roth?
Yeah, Uli John Roth. Yeah, he has one of those goofy, like, cleft asshole names.
Yeah.
Sorry to any bot listeners named Uli.
Yeah. But, no, Uli John Roth I knew from The Scorpions back in the 70s. Yeah, he was immensely talented guitarist.
Sure.
Very, very good.
And they talk about just, like, how, you know, this classical music. Like, of course you can't talk about classical music and metal and not mention Wagner.
Oh, of course not. No, no.
But there's one name that didn't come up that I thought was kind of odd was Franz Liszt.
Yes! You got exactly what I was saying. I just put that down my notes here because he was very dark. He was like the slayer of composers. Not fast, but really dark.
Well, and he was, by many accounts, the first rock star in terms of his appearance. Like, Liszt-o-mania was, you know, it's like Beatlemania was a take on that with the way women would just go nuts over him.
Yeah.
But he was the prototype for the rock and roll front man, you know.
You know what? I've got one of Liszt's albums, you know, done by, I think it was the Prague Orchestra or something like that. Dante's Inferno.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And that is, I mean, that stuff, some of the stuff in there, you could seriously put in a horror movie.
Really?
It is that frightening. I mean, it's really, really good. So, yeah. I was when I was going through my CDs the other day, just trying to pick something out for the car. I came across Liszt, and I thought, oh, you know, Franz Liszt, you know. And then we were doing the classical section on this episode. I was like, I didn't put any Franz Liszt in there because he was really dark.
And they talked to Geezer Butler and Bill Ward, who talk about Gustav Holst.
Yes,
and you know his planet suite, specifically Mars, the Bringer of War, is very influential on not just metal but all music. Like John Williams ripped it off in Star Wars. Like there are certain cues that are lifted straight from Holst.
But like they were talking about in the episode where they said about Black Sabbath with the tritonic sound.
Yeah.
The actual song Black Sabbath. Then they played that piece by Holst done by that orchestra. Yeah, I see what they're talking about.
Yep. Yeah. Like they said when they wrote Black Sabbath, Butler was kind of noodling around on his bass, kind of doing Mars, the Bringer of War. So,
yeah.
I mean, you have a really direct influence there. So, you know, there's, with classical, there's a lot of, you know, metal has a lot of grandiosity. There's a lot of virtuosity, which is what sets it apart from punk rock.
Yeah.
You know, people in metal like to know how to play their instruments extremely well.
Yeah.
You know, they don't like to half-ass it, you know. Whereas punk, it's like you don't even know how to play, you know, I mean. And you can kind of get by.
And not many punks out there, I mean, there might be some, but a great deal of them won't admit to actually being influenced by classical, being influenced by blues, by jazz.
I can see, like with punk, like because, you know, the Ramones were doing kind of old rock and roll stuff. And
oh, yeah.
They weren't
absolutely
good enough to really realize it. So this new sound happened. But punk, like, you know, I don't really hear much classical in punk. It's mostly like, you know, you can hear some blues in there, but a lot of old rock and roll, and of course the Clash sort of went into reggae with it and stuff.
Oh yeah,
but
yeah, well, that Sandinista album, my God.
Well, and it's kind of funny. Like later on in the series, you get some musicians who are really sniffy about being associated with metal. They don't like it, you know.
Yeah, we'll get to that when we get to that. Definitely.
Oh yeah, we'll get there.
We'll bring it up. But one of the other early roots as well they talk about is obviously blues,
of course,
and Howlin' Wolf.
Yeah, Howlin' Wolf, you know, has that gravelly, scary sounding voice. Like, you know, blues music was, you know, you wouldn't think about it today, but it sounded fucking evil back then.
Yeah, dude.
Like what was it? I watched this Terry Zwigoff documentary called Louie Bluey about this black string band musician.
Right.
Who was, you know, from back in the day. And he was talking about how when he was young, they'd play, like, you know, white parties and stuff.
Really?
But they'd kind of, yeah. But he said that one thing you did not do was play blues there, because that would freak them out and you'd probably get hurt, you know.
Jeez.
He said that it's just they didn't want to hear it. It scared them, you know.
Yeah.
It was too sexual. It was too evil sounding, you know. And, you know, Howlin' Wolf, you know, sounds fucking evil.
Yeah, he does.
You know, but Smokestack Lightning is one of my favorite blues songs. It's just so good. A haunting guitar riff.
But let me ask you something.
Which they talked to his old guitarist, too.
Did you like that when they put the subtitles up for the poor man who didn't need them?
Oh, yeah. I was like, I can understand him fine.
I completely understand what he's saying. I mean, it's...
But they go down to Mississippi, and it's like classic old blues guy. Like, you know, he's got oxygen in. He's dressed in a black suit. He's got this old acoustic guitar. I mean, he is like the stereotype of the old bluesman, like from Metalocalypse or something, like Mashed Potatoes Johnson or something. You know,
yeah, I remember.
But that was pretty great to, because he's like the last surviving member of Howlin' Wolf's band.
Because we've lost all the others. We've lost Johnny Hooker. We've lost.
Oh yeah.
And we've still got Buddy Guy. He's still alive. So.
Yeah. Fats Domino, you know.
No, that's right. Fats Domino's still alive.
Yeah.
Jeez.
Although if you go see Fats Domino live, if you hear he's playing live, and you go out to see him, there's a good chance he will not come on stage because he suffers from terrible stage fright.
Really?
Like I've heard about many times where there will be a concert and he just won't go out on stage. He's just too scared.
Jeez.
I mean, he's been doing this how long? But, you know, it's just one of those things you just never get over. He just never got over it.
Well, Harry Nilsson never did a concert, so...
Well, that's because Nilsson was too fucked up to do it.
I think that's about the right answer there. Okay.
But, of course, they go to Sun Studio, where you and I toured.
That's what I was getting to. We get to Memphis.
And we get to go to Sun, and they talk about... A lot of people cite Jackie Brenston and his Delta Cats' Rocket 88 as the first rock and roll song.
Yeah, with distortion.
And it was because they dropped the speaker and...
Shattered the
hole was in it, and they stuffed newspaper in it.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, was that exactly the same Empire we saw at Sun?
Yes, it was.
Oh, man.
Yep.
I don't know if it was a replica of the thing or what, but holy shit.
Yeah, they even have the first pressing of the album there, or the single.
That's right, yeah. But I do remember but I didn't know if the actual amplifier we saw was a replica or something like that. Yeah, wow, the actual amplifier is there at Sun. Those of you who haven't been to Sun Studio, honestly, it's really small. It's not like this huge place, but there's so much history in there that it takes a long time to soak it all up.
Yeah.
And then, like, because you and I, like as you said, you and I went there, we spent... a few hours there. And then go in the actual room that Elvis recorded, what was his first few singles in there?
Mm-hmm.
With Jerry Lee Lewis. Who else was in that picture? Jerry Lee Lewis, Johnny Cash.
And Carl Perkins.
Carl Perkins, that's right. Along with Elvis, I mean...
Million Dollar Quartet.
That's which is it, yes.
Great record. It's just a jam session between them, although I think Johnny Cash was just kind of hanging out. I don't think he was actually playing. But
who cares? Johnny Cash
is cool
still
to
there.
Hear Elvis and Jerry Lee Lewis kind of just bullshit and talk and then play some.
Yeah,
it's pretty amazing.
The Sun is an amazing place to go to. It really is. So
it is.
We get Sun Studios. We get jazz. They mention as an early roots influence. Yeah.
I love Iggy Pop. He's talking about jazz. A lot of jazz is just a lot of masturbation.
Yeah. What did I write down here in my notes here? Iggy Pop says. All jazz sounds like shit, except for a few artists out there.
Well, and you know what, though? Like, bad jazz is fucking intolerable. Like, I went to a music festival a few weeks ago, and there was this experimental jazz band there. I wanted to fucking kill myself. It was the worst
freeform style I've ever heard. Just awful, yeah.
But, I mean, it was literally, like, one of the worst bands I've ever seen live. They could play, they just couldn't play decent music. Like,
right.
Or they chose not to. It was terrible. Huh. I mean, like a lot of screaming into a microphone and like, oh, I'm going to take a whistle and blow it into mic. It's just terrible. yeah, they talk about jazz some, and Bill Ward talks about growing up listening to jazz and the big bands and stuff. And, you know, jazz is, you know, you could see jazz like, you know, in Megadeth and stuff, like the way the music just turns and twists and...
Oh, yeah.
Megadeth, when Dave Mustaine formed it, he got a jazz guitarist and a jazz drummer, Chris Poland and Gar
Samuelson,
Samuelson, yeah, to play in there. And of course, since they're jazz musicians, that also meant they mainlined Heroin. But
yeah, okay. Then we get a few more interviews. We get an interview with Jeff Tater Queensryche, who in this video looks more like a wine critic.
Oh, totally. Jeff Tate is so, like, he's so manicured, and he's got his glass of wine and his nice shirt.
His buttoned-up shirt, yeah.
Painted horses behind him, and he's talking about, they talk about some of the operatic qualities of vocals. Like, they talk to Rob Halford, and he talks about working at a theater and seeing opera and stuff.
Did you find it, not surprising, but I found it odd that he cited Pavarotti as his god, as his vocal god.
Oh, yeah.
That's incredible, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you can kind of see it in their Take Cover album. He does a cover, I can't remember the name of the song, because it's, you know, some other language, but yeah. It's kind of an opera-sounding song.
Okay, and we get a few more interviews with, and these are the ones I really liked. We got an interview with Bob Ezrin and Eddie Kramer, two producing gods of the 70s.
Yeah, Bob Ezrin, you know, is one of the, you know, faces on Mount Rushmore of rock producers, you know?
Yeah, he is, along with Phil Spector. As insane as Phil Spector is, Bob Ezrin. Yeah. Bob Ezrin was just as insane, apparently, when he was doing the... which album was it? I think it was the Alice Cooper Welcome to My Nightmare one or Kiss's Destroyer.
Well, I know he said that Kiss's music from The Elder was fueled mostly by his cocaine habits.
Then that's the one I'm thinking of. Kiss music from The Elder was purely... Yeah, produced on cocaine.
I mean, that's an idea that just comes from too much fame and money, you know, where everything sounds like a good idea.
But I will go on the record and say the Kiss music from The Elder is one very underrated album. I really like it.
I think it's all right. There's a few songs I like on there.
I think it was a bold, ambitious move that got heavily pummeled into the ground unnecessarily.
Well, it was kind of a weird... It was a marketing misstep because it was a soundtrack for a movie that hadn't been made yet.
Still hasn't been made yet.
No, exactly. Like, it's just because the album bombed so hard. But
if you actually listen to the music from The Elder, if you listen to the story, it's got elements of Tales of the Black Freighter that would come out 5 or 6 years later.
Yeah.
The Watchmen graphic novel. Don't think there's much of a connection there, obviously, but it's laced throughout Tales of the Black Freighter.
But, like, you know, it's just like, I think... They were like, oh, this is music from The Elder. It wasn't like, hey, let's make a rock opera and then try to get a movie made about it or something.
Yeah.
You know, like with Tommy or Quadrophenia or whatever. Jeff Tate's still trying to get his Operation Mindcrime movie made.
That would be a good film.
But you know, they were... It just seemed like a marketing mistake. Like, they needed to have something to go with it film-wise, and they didn't.
Then we get an interview with... a guy who I was really impressed with, Kirk Hammett, who came across as really, really bright. Well, compared to when you have him up against that Lars, who just talks.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Kirk is, you can tell he's probably the more well-adjusted member of Metallica. Not as many problems there. Kirk showed up pretty early on. He's throughout it and talks about, like, the blues riffs and metal riffs and sitting on the riff, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know. We get interviews with Carmine Appice as well. He looks like Rambo in First Blood. You know when they have that flashback of Rambo being hoisted up on the cross by the Vietnamese?
Yeah, he does with that mustache.
Yeah, with that mustache. That's the Rambo.
Have you ever seen the movie Black Roses with Carmine Appice?
No.
Holy shit. It's by the guy who did Rock and Roll Nightmare.
Yeah.
And it's about this like metal band that turns into monsters or something.
No, I've never heard of it.
In the band in it, the Carmine Appice is the drummer. But, yeah, you got to see it, Stu. It's pretty terrible, but you'd like it.
I'm sure I would like it, yeah. Okay.
If you haven't seen Rock and Roll Nightmare, also check that out.
Oh, yeah.
That's a really shitty movie, but delightfully so.
And we get another interview with the crazy-ass Kim Fowley.
Oh, yeah, Kim Fowley. By the way, seeing him in person makes me just go, man, Michael Shannon's a good actor.
Yeah, doesn't
you
it?
Know? He nailed
you'd
that guy.
You'd swear that was his fucking Runaways mirror image. He's like, you'd swear that was Kim Fowley had stepped out of his body 30 years earlier and walked straight into the Runaways film.
Yeah.
That's how good that was. I tell you what was the lesson you learned from this episode more than anything?
Oh, goodness.
I know we're not finished up, but I just got to ask this now.
Oh, you know, the composition of Sabbath's eponymous track that sort of kickstarted heavy metal, that's one that, like, every time I hear how it came about, the story's different, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, they, you know, oh, Geezer Butler had a dream and then made it, and then in this, like, I was kind of like, okay, he was playing Holst, and it kind of came together, you know, and Bill Ward has the same exact story.
Okay. Well.
So, you know, it just, I thought that was interesting, because, like, that's one of those things you always hear different stories about, and so that was one I hadn't heard yet, so it's kind of, but hearing it from two different people, the same account, was, made it a little stronger.
Well, I'll tell you the lesson I learned for this episode, which I kind of knew, but then I really knew about. And for those of you who haven't heard of this guy, you'll know that Buddy Rich can fucking play the drums.
Oh, yes. Buddy Rich is a monster.
Holy sh... I had no idea.
You did, really?
I mean, I knew the name Buddy Rich. I knew that he was revered, but I had no idea he was that good.
Yeah.
Holy shit. And Gene Krupa as well. They show a few seconds of Gene Krupa, and it's like, this guy can play as well. And you can see where metal drummers get their influence from.
Worshipped Krupa and Rich, you know.
Well, like Paul Bostoff, the drummer for Slayer and Forbidden, one of his first bands, he said there will never be another drummer better than Buddy Rich.
Yeah.
And that's not bad. I mean, that guy's good. Paul Bostoff.
I mean, you always hear about, oh, you know, Keith Moon's the best drummer of all time. Oh, Neil Peart's the best drummer of all time.
And John Bonham.
It's kind of hard to top those guys, Krupa and Rich. It is. You know?
Considering the drum set they had was really minimal compared to what Bonham had, compared to what Moon had. Yeah. Compared to what Pert had. Yeah, that's right.
Anytime, though, a musician dies prematurely, I think they get a little hyperbole surrounding them, you know?
But Buddy Rich was good.
No, I'm not talking about him. I'm talking about, like, you know, Bonham and...
Oh, right, right. John Bonham, yeah. But John Bonham's good.
Oh, he is good. I'm just saying, it's like the Randy Rhoads effect, though.
Yeah.
Like Lemmy said, I've never seen a good guitarist go to being a fucking phenomenal guitarist the way Randy Rhoads did when he died.
Yeah. What else we got? Then we go into the British Invasion. We start talking about the Kinks.
Yeah.
Eh.
More,
I suppose,
distortion.
It's warranted. I mean, yeah.
You hear more about the distortion and...
Yeah.
You know, the Kinks were a sweaty, sexy band. You know, those guitar licks are infectious. Well, yeah. Not sexy them. I'm talking about their music. They're
ugly
shit.
Understand.
But,
yeah.
You know.
Well, the woman from the Pretenders found one of the Kinks sexy and married him, didn't she?
Yeah, she did. She, but, you know, women are wired differently.
They are, aren't they, really? Interview with Glenn Hughes. I got here in my notes. Looks like SpongeBob SquarePants with long hair.
You know, a lot of these guys don't, you know, they look like, you know, they're healthy, but, you know, a lot of them, they're old now, and they just don't look good, you know?
Well, Glenn Hughes, from what I heard, had a Mars bar addiction.
Really?
Yeah, really bad. He bloated out something vicious. So, I mean, he's trimmed down a lot now, is what you see in this documentary, but... He got really heavy at one point because he was just, like, snacking on Mars bars all day.
He was a literal chocoholic.
Yeah, really he was. Then we get a few more interviews. You know, we get some with Billy Gibbons, which was good to see. Then they talk about The Who. They talk about Jimi Hendrix, obviously. Then one of my favorite parts of this whole episode, we get to go to the Marshall Factory in England.
Oh, that was awesome.
That was...
To hear about the Marshall amps and just the genesis of Marshall and... How Pete Townshend was, like, a big part of that.
Yeah, I had no idea he was a big... Yeah,
me neither. That was so weird.
I mean, we really got to credit The Who a lot with the progression of heavy metal and the birth of metal.
Yeah, they really, like... Because Townshend's playing really just pushed the boundaries of what guitar players can do.
Yeah.
And
he was never a really talented guitarist. He was a talented songwriter, but not really a talented guitarist. And he knew that. He knew his limits, but he really pushed the volume with that band.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what got us the Marshall. Well, originally the Marshall was a one piece, and it was too heavy, so it became a stack. And that's how we learned about the genesis of the Marshall amp. Did you like the amp that went to 11?
Yes, they had the Spinal. It even had Spinal Tap on it.
Yeah, it did. That was a real novelty amp. But just I don't know if they actually market it or if it's just something they've got for themselves as a laugh.
I'm sure they must. That would sell. You know,
God,
they've got to market that.
Yeah, I'm sure they're out there. The amp that goes to 11. That is awesome. Okay.
All right. Well, that's episode one. But the roots of metal are not over yet.
No, they're not. They're just getting started.
So the next episode, episode two. Is early metal in the United States.
Yeah. All right, so we start off with our KISS convention, which I don't know if you've ever been to a KISS convention. They are fun.
I have not, which is too bad, because
okay, so it's not, I'd love to it's go not to actually one. Something you plan to do, or you do want to go to one, you just never gotten to one.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. No, KISS conventions are fun. I mean, you know, KISS fans are rather unique. They seem to put KISS on a pedestal a lot higher than what they really should be, but, you know, they're good fun. I've been to one.
I think a lot of them kind of know what KISS is, though. You know, they kind of know it's kind of a marketing juggernaut, but it's also, like, really fun music. It's kind of a fun time, you know?
Yeah, but actually, it's really odd because one of the biggest KISS fans who runs one of the biggest KISS sites was based in Italy.
Really?
Yeah, and he actually lives now here in Melbourne. He married his wife is from Melbourne, and they live down here now. And all the KISS conventions that are held down here are run by him and his wife. And I can't remember the name of his Nikolai or Nicky or something. Like that. That's his name. But what magazine he ran? I can't remember. You know, fanzines from the '90s and all that shit before the internet was around. Mm-hmm. It was one of the biggest ones, and he still had a very big connection with KISS.
You know, because Gene Simmons was really entrenched in that fan culture he was, you know, before he was the demon of KISS, you know. And so he really kept his finger on the pulse of that.
Yeah.
And so when he sees a fan doing something awesome, he wouldn't, like, you know, shut him down. He'd call him and just say, hey, look. We need something like this going. Let's get a deal going, and we can both make money off this, you know?
Well, this guy, actually, from what I was told, I think he might have told me himself, him and his wife were in the front row of the KISS MTV Unplugged special.
Wow.
Yeah, they actually got the front row seats there, but from Gene. So he was pretty heavily steeped. Yeah. But KISS conventions, like, for those of you out there who haven't been to them, they're good fun.
Like, you know, Gene Simmons, yeah, he's a douchebag and stuff, but he seems to really, like, you know, seems to take care of his own, you know?
But Gene Simmons, like, you and I have championed how smart this guy is.
Yeah, he's a really smart guy. I mean, when you hear him talk, you're like, he's obviously intelligent. He's obviously
intelligent,
in love with himself, but he's a rock star.
He's a rock star, but the thing is, well, he knows what the fans want, and he will accommodate them.
Yeah.
But he won't rush it all out. He won't get two or three fans saying, hey, you should release KISS Live in Largo 79 on DVD, and he'll go, okay, I'll do it by tomorrow. It doesn't work that way.
No.
He'll know what the fans want, and then he'll wait. Because, you know, they'll want it. They'll still want it 12 months down the line.
I still want my Criterion edition of KISS Meets the Phantom of the Park.
Hell yes, I do.
I mean, or actually, it could be on our Anus Films collection.
We really got to start that Anus Films up with you.
We need to start Anus Films.
Yourself.
the Criterion collection or whatever. Yeah. Patent pending.
Now, this is something that's a bit contentious with me. I don't know about yourself. Surf guitar considered it as heavy in its day.
It was kind of fast, and I mean, I love Dick Dale. Like, they talked to Dick Dale.
Dick Dale had a t-shirt which said Dick Dale for president on it?
Yes, it is. And his guitars say Dick Dale on them, so.
Yeah.
If you will not forget his name. But,
no, he won't.
He's, I mean, but I really love his playing. I think he's. His sound is really fresh and inventive. And,
oh, he's a pioneer. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't know how relevant he is to metal, but I mean, he does sort of have a... His playing does have kind of a metallic, raw, animalistic quality. No, not raw, but an elemental nature to it that I like.
Yeah, it does.
You know.
So they do speak to Dick Dale for a little bit and his influence, and then
well,
we get
like, you know, you can kind of hear his influence in, like, because, like, he talks about using the guitar like a drum. And stuff like that, and kind of using it, like, in a more thumping way. And, like, you could see that in stuff like Meshuga. Like, you know, just the way they pound those guitars.
Yeah.
You could see kind of the genesis of that.
But then we get into the good stuff. We get into some Ted Nugent.
Yeah, dude. I knew you were going to lose your shit when Ted Nugent showed up.
Oh, you knew that.
And the best is Sam goes, we're going to try, the hardest part is going to try to not get him to talk about hunting or politics. And immediately cut to Ted Nugent burping before
Barack
the camera.
Obama's
name. Barack Obama. It's the only use I found for those syllables, expelling gas.
I love Ted Nugent. I don't care. I know our
I don't care what any of you motherfuckers say. The Nuge is great.
The Nuge is, I mean, I will forever champion his Ted White and Blue. His audio book is just insane. He's just, oh my God, just about. Yeah, his methods of controlling the illegal alien across the border is just something straight out of the asylum. It really is. I dare not repeat it, definitely. But yeah, it was good. We get some Ted Nugent. Got some of the Amboy Dukes, his early band before. Yeah, which was, I mean, I knew the Amboy Dukes. I got their four albums.
One of the great early garage rock bands, because that's kind of the, they start talking about garage rock and that's in its influence.
Yeah, Journey to the Center of the Mind. Yeah, definitely a huge hit for them back in 67 or 68, something like that. Mm-hmm. Nugent looks so different in that video as well. That was a time when, no, I'm not going to say it, don't worry. I'll bypass that just in case.
But they also talked to John Kay from Steppenwolf.
Oh, no, right?
And that's like, everybody always talks about where the term heavy metal come from. And no matter who you talk to, like Alice Cooper goes, oh, I first heard it in Rolling Stone when they were talking about my band, or,
yeah,
you know, everybody has a different story, like, and usually they apply it to themselves. But you hear John Kay say heavy metal thunder in
Born to Be Wild. Yeah.
So, you know, I'm just going to go ahead and just apply it there.
I think that's about the real origin of it there.
I'm sure it was probably used before, but I'm just going to go ahead and just go with John Kay on that one.
Yeah, I think that's about right.
Really badass band, though, the MC5.
Okay, now here is where we get a bit contentious, because I do not consider MC5 anything to do with the metal roots. Punk roots, yes,
but
metal,
they're garage rock, you know. Mm. I mean, and like, you know, but I think that they do have a big influence on a lot of metal bands. Like, their stuff is fast and hard and raw and loose. Like, it's heavy. You know, you talk to, like, you know, look at Rage Against the Machine. They cover Kick Out the Jams and stuff. Mm. You know, I think that a lot of metal bands were listening to them growing up.
Yeah, that's where I put my notes here. I got a real problem with the MC5 being included in there.
I mean, they're harder and faster than the Amboy Dukes, you know?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Nugent even cops to that.
Oh, yeah, he says MC5 just blew him away when he first saw him and heard him. Yeah, MC5, I definitely dispute the Stooges. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Punk, absolutely, the Stooges are the godfathers, along with the Ramones, but not metal. And I mean,
that's kind of going off in a different direction, I think.
Yeah.
With the Stooges, you know.
Yeah.
I think it's the garage rock, I think you can definitely connect those bands to metal, but the Stooges are a little like, I think that they're a little more connected to that punk community.
Absolutely, so. Yeah. Because, and I only say that for this reason, because there's some omissions here that they've made out, whether it's deliberate or just oversights, I don't know, that I'll bring up later towards in the show that I penciled down, that I thought you could have easily removed the Stooges out of there and put one or two of these bands in there.
Hmm.
Quite easily, and probably more appropriately as well. So there's that. We get some Alice Cooper. Obviously, we're going to get a lot of Alice Cooper.
Cover Alice Cooper. Oh,
absolutely, I have to. And did you notice that thing where they showed a very early piece of footage of the Alice Cooper band on stage? Was that stage that guy who jumps off the speaker stand and jumps on Alice? Or was that an intruder?
I have no idea.
Okay, you didn't catch that?
No, I missed that.
Okay, because some guy is like jumps off a 6 or 7 foot high speaker stand and jumps straight on Alice. So it looks like it's a real fight, like somebody's jumped, rushed the stage and gone to beat Alice up, but I couldn't tell if it was staged or not. So I suppose you guys watch and make your own mind up on it, but it looked like somebody actually gone to beat Alice.
I thought it was just part of the show, I guess. I don't know.
It could have been. I mean, this show was so insanely wild that you would know what was real and what was staged. And okay, and we get a few interviews with Peter Criss, Ace Frehley.
Yeah, and I think it's funny, there's a recurring thing in these episodes where you talk to the guys who aren't in the band anymore, you know?
That is a good point.
Like, because there's a lot of former members they talk to. They talk to some current members, but, like, of the bands they talk to. But, like, you know, in a later episode, they talk about Genesis, and they go and talk to the former guitarist of Genesis, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, they're talking to, I mean, and I'm sure it's hard to, you know, talk to Phil Collins or whatever.
Yeah.
But I also think it's kind of interesting to get the Peter Criss, Ace Frehley take, because, you know, the Gene Simmons, Paul Stanley take, you've heard it a million times. It's the canned Kistery response. Hearing from Peter and Ace is kind of cool, because I like Ace Frehley a lot.
Yeah, I suppose it's going to be more...
I like Peter Criss as a guy. I don't, like, love his music, but...
Yeah. I think Peter Criss is more... a bit more honest with... I mean, he's got nothing more to lose, really.
No.
No pun intended. But, yeah, I mean, I suppose I can sort of see why what you're talking about. It's kind of good to get it from another perspective instead of the band leaders.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so.
I think so, because, I mean, they're still in promo mode and stuff.
Oh, Kiss always will be, so.
You know, I mean, all of them are, so who are still active. So, you know, it's kind of interesting to go back and get just somebody who's not really invested in it anymore.
Yeah. What I liked, though, about the Ace Frehley Peter Criss interview was the
the evolution of the Alive album, which was really pivotal
That was
Chris's
cool.
career, because they were kind of going nowhere. They were sort of semi big.
They had a cult. They had a following. Like, their live shows were huge, but their albums weren't. They weren't moving albums.
Not really, no.
And it was, you know, you listen to those earlier. Like, I think, you know, the first Kiss record's a lot of fun, and but you know, they don't really capture the spirit of Kiss the way Alive does. Alive is a great record.
It is. You know. It's a lot better than Alive 2. Alive 2 is just a bit of a mess, really. Save for Side B, which I actually quite like quite a bit. Well, Record 2
has
Side
its
B.
Moments.
Yeah, it's. I mean, it's got its charm, but Alive is a lot more raw. Alive always sounded like Kiss had something to prove.
Yeah.
Alive 2 sounded like they didn't have nothing to prove. They'd already done it. So that was what the big difference was between the two Alive albums, and Alive 3 and 4 don't really count at all. Sorry, Kiss fans.
Well, yeah, Alive 3 is kind of, that's makeupless Kiss.
Yeah, that's right. We get a story on Aerosmith from Tom Hamilton, probably the most irrelevant member of Aerosmith as well.
Well, and here's the thing. I thought we spent way too much time with fucking Aerosmith.
We did.
This,
I mean, they were,
in this documentary.
They were too much time on Aerosmith. I mean, what we get, a good 8-9 minutes on them?
Yeah.
I mean, they're important, but when you're dealing with a 40-45 minute show, you know, that sort of time to really waste on Aerosmith. Yeah, we knew the band was imploding by the end of the 70s. I mean, we didn't need 5 minutes on that section.
No.
You know, it wasn't really worth it. You could have stripped that back to at least a 3-4 minute interview.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you can mention them and stuff, and the footage of Steven Tyler early on is really incredible.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's just, it's fucking Aerosmith. We get it. Let's move on.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Aerosmith is really Aerosmith. I mean, there's not much really you can more elaborate on. They've been around, what, 40-something years.
But it was kind of funny to talk about Kiss's move away from the metal community, like with Beth.
That was a waste of time. I'm sorry. We didn't.
Well, it was funny, though. The part I think they should have spent more time on than Beth, because they spent a long time on Beth.
Yeah.
I mean, fucking I Was Made for Loving You is a much...
A more radical departure than what?
Yeah, Beth that was Kiss. That was Kiss. Like almost like that was a betrayal.
Oh yeah, that was
Kiss
dancing with the enemy. That's what it was.
No, that was them. They did a disco song, and when you watch that footage, and Paul Stanley's howling like Donna Summer, it's just like what the fuck?
Exactly. You know? Yeah. So I mean, I found the Beth thing unnecessary because I already know that, but I suppose I can't be selfish about it and say, well, I know that, so this is a waste of time. You know, it's got to be for the masses out there who don't know it more than what. Say I would have Kiss fans,
and it is a huge moment in Kiss history.
Oh, it was
history.
History. Yeah, it was massive. Now we get the something that I'd seen a bit of footage of before in the past, and I really want the whole concert of Ted Nugent's anyway at California Jam 2 in 1978.
Yeah, that was cool.
Oh,
that was when he was solo by that point.
Yeah, but I've always chased this down. Like, I never find it. I don't know if there's a full thing of it out there. Or there's snippets or what. But I've got a couple of tracks on a Ted Nugent DVD I've got. But, boy, I really want to see that whole concert. Oh, then we get the last bit we get in there. Is about, they talk about, well, they talk with that lady from Cream Magazine, which says that disco was killing off, you know, hard, heavy rock, which we all knew by the time the 70s came along.
But, you know, the public wised up and destroyed all their disco records.
Yeah. And Exodus burnt one of them at a concert back in the early 80s as well. Good old Exodus, yeah. Let's backpedal one bit a bit earlier in the episode. Blue Cheer.
Yeah.
Have you heard a lot of them or just Summertime Blues?
I've only heard Summertime Blues. They played at the High Tone in Memphis one time, and I was going to go see it, but I got sick or something, and I couldn't go.
Right.
I was really bummed out, and I think this was before the dude died from that band.
Yeah, the main vocalist, yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't catch his name. But Blue Cheer aren't a metal band, I'm sorry. Summertime Blues, best version I've ever heard of it.
Geddy Lee seems to think they are.
Yeah. I think what the thing may have been with Blue Cheer, they were loud. And so you thought when you watched them live, they were a metal band. They may have been, the guitar.
I think, I don't really consider them metal. They just seem loud. Like, because whenever they talk about them, they just say, they just talked about how loud they were.
Did you like the guitarist from Blue Cheer? What did he look like? Wait, Ron Jeremy.
Oh, yeah, he does.
Fat mustache, wispy hair, wispy long hair.
Yeah.
But I'm sorry. I've heard some songs of Blue Cheer out there, and I wouldn't put them in the same vein as other bands. That's for sure.
I mean, you know, I could see a little bit of influence, but I don't see the need to spend a whole lot of time on them. You know,
no. I think that's sort of you know clutching the straws with Blue Cheer.
They were a blip on, like, in Metal, A Headbanger's Journey. Geddy Lee brought them up, but he called them, you know, he was like, they were a blip on the radar, but they were like the loudest band for the time.
Yeah, that's about it. Okay. So,
getting to the awards end here now. The glaring omissions that I found. Did you say you found any at all? You've got none?
No. I mean, you seem to be covering it pretty well. So.
Okay. So the ones I had were Grand Funk Railroad. I thought definitely had to be there. Blue Oyster Cult should have been there, and which is weird because when you look on the ladder of the family tree of metal,
yeah,
in this particular subgenre, you do see Blue Oyster Cult written there and Grand Funk Railroad.
So they acknowledge them to some extent.
They acknowledge them, but they
have this flow chart that they constantly refer to. It was in Metal Headbanger's Journey, but they've expanded it quite significantly.
Yeah, yeah.
And that would be a cool poster to have.
It would be, actually. I've never thought of that.
Yeah. It's a really cool chart that he's put together.
And the one last glaring omission is Mountain.
Oh yeah, Mountain.
My God.
Yeah.
I mean, they spoke to Corky Lang, the drummer from Mountain. Mountain more metal than what Blue Cheer ever would be. Mountain were heavy. I mean, really,
yeah, they
and
were.
Loud. I mean, they didn't speak about Leslie West as an influential guitarist at all. You know, they spoke to Nugent a lot. Obviously, I still consider Nugent the most influential guitarist of the last 30, 40 years. But
Can't Scratch Fever. Sorry.
But Mountain to be overlooked like that. I like I said, I don't know if it was a time constraint thing, but I couldn't see them on that family tree poster.
Oh yeah, that is an omission.
Yeah, and Mountain are an American band, so don't know. Couldn't work that one out. You know, see, that's the thing I was thinking about this show, right? It's a VH1 production. What if VH1 can't get access to clips? Okay, fair enough. You can't get access to clips. Doesn't mean you can't mention the band and acknowledge the band. Even if you reel off a list and say, oh, also along with other bands like Blue Oyster Cult, Mountain, Grand Funk Railroad. Okay, then I wouldn't have had to put that down and say,
little
hey.
Lip service.
Yeah, that way I wouldn't have had to put them down and say, hey, you missed them all together. I would have said, at least you acknowledge them. Okay, I understand you can't show everybody, you can't explain everybody's life story. Otherwise, you'd be here for 20 years. But, yeah, an acknowledgement would have been nice. But, like I said, that may have been an oversight. It may have been cut from the show. I don't know. So, that's that. That's episode 2. All done. Yep. And that's us all done for this episode as well.
Yep, that'll do us.
Like I said, next part to this series from us will be episodes 3 to 5.
Mm-hmm.
And
so go look them up and watch them.
Go look them up and watch them. Get your hands on them somehow or another, wherever you are, because this...
It's easy to do.
Very easy to do. Exactly. Because this is a series really worth your time. You mightn't like all the music you're going to hear in it, because when you get towards some of the later episodes, it's like... I was sitting there thinking, oh, God, I gotta listen to this shit, but yeah, we'll get to that when we get to that.
All right, well, you can find us at midnightmoviecowboys.com. Send us an email at midnightmoviecowboys@gmail.com. And if you are subscribed on iTunes and you like this show, please, please, please go give us a review and click 5 stars, because it really would help us out. You can follow us on Twitter at MMCowboys. You can follow me on Twitter at Hunter Deucing, D as in David, U-E-S-I-N-G. You can follow Stu at The Real Rebel. That's Real, R-E-E-L, Rebel.
Yep.
And, yeah, so.
And Facebook, we're there as well.
Oh, yeah,
and
like us on Facebook.
We're there as well. All right, till next episode. See you later.
Adios.
Tell me, I'm so scared. Your little head.